Good morning. We bring you now a roundup of the latest news reported direct by NBC correspondents overseas and in the national capital. Our first report comes from the Russian capital, and we take you now to Robert Magadov in Moscow.
This is Robert Magadov speaking from Moscow. Stalin's recent statement on the Second Front has caused tremendous excitement among the Russians, but the Soviet press has not commented on it as yet. However, a cartoon in today's Pravda gives the names of the generals who are holding up the works for the Second Front. They are generals, better not risk it, think again, suppose they lick us, wait and see, and why hurry? The one thing these generals can't hold up is the clock on the wall, which is pointing to 11:30, and the calendar shows October 1942. The white whiskers of the generals droop over a map which has been laid out before them by two energetic young men named General Courage and General Determination, truly ready for action, and are even wearing steel helmets. The cartoonist has made the hesitating old generals look as if they need a great deal of prodding. The war on Russia, in the meantime, is raging without respite. But no major change has taken place at Stalingrad or the other centers of fighting. This war has scattered thousands of Soviet families all over the face of the Russian earth. The danger of juvenile vagrancy is again threatening the young generation of the Soviet Union, although most of the waifs have parents or at least relatives. A special bureau has been opened in Moscow to grapple with this problem. The bureau, headed by Mikhail Tipograf, a man with 15 years of experience and looking for lost children after the Civil War, when juvenile vagrancy was one of Russia's gravest social problems. This bureau is daily receiving hundreds of letters from parents who have lost their children during raids on cities or during evacuation. Yes, to look for a lost child now is like looking for a needle in 50 haystacks. But we find them, the director of the bureau said. He told me of a case with a Leningrad militiaman who was fighting with guerrillas behind the German lines. The bureau traced his child and found ways of reaching him where the Gestapo failed. Thousands of families have already been reunited by the bureau. Goodbye from Moscow.
We turn next to Stockholm, Sweden, for the report of David Anderson.
From 5 o'clock this morning, a state of emergency has existed in the Trondheim district in Norway. In an order issued by the German Reich Commissar in Norway, Ter Boven, it states that a number of acts of sabotage have recently taken place, quote, which, if they had succeeded, would have jeopardized the country's supply situation, unquote. In conjunction with a state of emergency, the German police chief in Norway, Redis, has issued a number of regulations. All theaters are to remain closed. Public meetings are prohibited. Railways are to be used only by the German armed forces. A curfew is placed on the populace between the hours of 8 at night to 5 in the morning, and restaurants and streetcars are to stop operating at 7 o'clock at night. Then, too, the local Quisling leader, Rogstad, described by Norwegian circles here as an ambitious Nazi about 25 years of age and known for his cruelty, has been given charge of the administration of all Norwegian affairs in the Trondheim district. Norwegian circles here in Stockholm point out three possible reasons for the state of emergency. In the first place, the state of emergency has been declared along the railway line leading from Trondheim to northern Norway. Since the Germans have transported troops in great quantities to northern Norway over this line, it is possible that loyal Norwegians try to disrupt this traffic. Secondly, two oppositional groups have come to light in the Quislingites of Trondheim. One is the so-called German element, and the other is the Norwegian element. The first group is said to look forward to the incorporation of Norway into the greater Germania, while the Norwegian element is for restricting their ambitions to purely Norwegian territory. The third reason may be that trouble has blown up in the new ordered trade union movement in Trondheim. Three of the trade union leaders in this district have just been ousted from the Nationalsamling. Whatever the reasons may be, it is clear that the people of Trondheim are once again in the disfavor of the Germans. In Denmark, too, the Germans seem to be dissatisfied. You've already heard, no doubt, of the German ambitions to turn Denmark into a second Norway. The development in this direction has been speeded up during the past few days. The German minister in Copenhagen, Renfe Fink, has returned to Berlin, and the Danish minister in Germany, Mohr, has returned to Copenhagen. This indicated a break in diplomatic relations, but a compromise has been agreed upon by which the first secretary of the respective legations will take over the duties of the minister. Then, too, it is reported today that General Lütke, the head of the German occupational troops in Denmark, has returned to Germany permanently. It is said that he was too kind. His place is to be taken by General Heidelberg. Further indications of the high degree of tension in the Danish capital is the fact that the guards around the royal palace Amalienborg have been quadrupled. The tension is growing hourly in the Danish capital, and big news is awaited from there at any moment. This is David Anderson returning you now to New York.
Now to our own national capital for the report of Richard Harkness, who speaks from the newsroom in Washington.
Here in Washington, reports plainly show this morning that the United States is on the offensive across the whole Pacific battlefront. That American Army, Navy, and Marine flyers are teaming together to smash Japanese forces in Alaska and in the far-off Solomon Islands on the other side of the world. Up in the Northwest Pacific, American Army bombers are turning the Aleutian Islands into a veritable death trap for the Japanese. For the Navy reveals in its latest communique that American Army bombers are keeping Japanese-occupied Kiska under continual fire, and attempts by the Japanese to defend themselves have proved futile. The Navy says that our flyers shot down 5 enemy seaplanes on October 2nd and rained many demolition and incendiary bombs on Japanese military installations. And we've apparently captured some prisoners in the Aleutians. For 5 Japanese. 5 Japanese reportedly captured as a result of naval action in Alaska have been landed at a Pacific coast port. The Japanese prisoners were believed to be the first to reach the continental United States during the present conflict. The prisoners were landed by the Navy and handed over to the Army. The captured Japanese were then taken under heavy military guard and put in an undisclosed, previously prepared camp. And in the Southwest Pacific, the American Army and Navy and Marine pilots have made 8 separate attacks in 4 days on Japanese forces. Japanese forces which are seeking to move closer and closer to our base on Guadalcanal. But despite this terrific bombing, despite what must be a heavy toll of life, the Japs have managed to land small troop units on the island. And meanwhile, there's no news here. There's no confirmation at all of Axis claims that a big naval battle is underway in the Solomons. A battle in which the Axis claims that the American Navy suffered heavy losses. Naval observers in Washington believe, however, well, they feel certain that events out there are shaping up toward a large-scale counterattack by the Japanese in an attempt to drive our flag off Guadalcanal. Of course, the battle in the Pacific isn't all one-sided in our favor. We've lost a submarine during operations against the Japs. The underseas craft was the Grunion, and the crew of 65 officers and men must be presumed lost. And here on the home front, the Senate begins debate this morning on the new $7 billion tax bill. But the Senate will consider the measure with one eye on the Treasury Department. For Secretary Morgenthau announced late yesterday that the administration will ask soon for another big tax bill, a bill of at least $6 billion and probably more. Mr. Morgenthau wouldn't say what kind of a new levy the Treasury was planning, but it looks as if the program will embrace some form of compulsory savings. And that's all from Washington.
Now we take you overseas again, this time to the British capital. Go ahead, Alex Dreyer in London.
This is Alex Dreyer reporting from London. Prime Minister Churchill today stated that this government has given consideration to the Stalin letter, but that no amplification on the subject concerned would be given at this time. And this is the day which Oliver Littleton, the Minister of Production 80 days ago, said the war would enter into a new phase. On September 16th, when but 19 of his 80 days were left, he commented, "We are approaching the breathless moment when if Russia can hold on to her present positions for a few more weeks, the balance will begin to swing in our direction. Those days are up. This is the 81st day. Stalingrad is still meat-grinding Nazis by the thousands. And last night, the RAF, again pounded Western Germany. And on this day, a British night fighter pilot, one of the many who will herald in the new phase of the war, gives us his intimate credo. He says that before September 1939, all he knew of war was what he read about other wars, and that his whole attitude of mind was colored by the magazine cartoons of 1914 to 1918. War to this British night fighter smacked of movies like the Dawn Patrol, and even on his 18th birthday, when he joined the Royal Air Force, his attitude of mind was as it was before. But from the moment his sleek little Hurricane poured its hot lead into Messerschmitt's and Heinkel bombers, his education, as he puts it, began. This night fighter tells us he soon discovered that all the lessons of war are commonplace. And as it is the commonplace man who is worthwhile, so it is the commonplace lesson that is the true one. The more he patrolled the darkness in the British skies, the more he realized giving up your home and submitting your life was the real sacrifice. That wars are not won by emotion, but by sheer industry. That the frontline soldier was not the man who would render the war's decision, because he is merely the flesh and blood who demonstrates the ability or failure of his leaders to organize. He grew cynically aware that death in his night fighter wasn't going to speed up or prolong the war, unless, as he says, the air marshals get really bad at arithmetic and lose all of his pals. This youth who loves the ordinary things soon found out what he was in the war for and why. And after a year's service, there was no jingo in his heart, and his mind was filled with as little prejudice as possible. Flag waving, he knows, will not buy bread during the war or after it. And he wonders how many people have worked out why. And now, this is Alex Dreyer in London, switching you to Cairo.
Hello, New York. This is Grant Parr speaking from Cairo, Egypt. Making use of the comparative inactivity in the Western Front skies, our American fighter squadrons are getting settled in the desert. Being forced to live in forward areas, these airmen can't hope for the comparative ease of the bomber groups, but with what they have, they've done well. This is how one group of air officers fixed their mess tent. First of all, they got straw mats to cover the sand floor. Then they made a bar and refreshment stand from packing cases. The stand was fitted with an ancient icebox to provide cool drinks. For lounging, several canvas deck chairs were obtained. The next item was entertainment. The airmen pooled their spare cash and bought a portable phonograph with electric pickup attachment. They connected this to a radio which one of the officers had brought with him. It was too small to get any but local stations anyway. Radio news and other entertainment are heard over a 5-band shortwave radio provided by the Army. The distance involved and the difference in time makes it difficult to pick up American programs, but these are eagerly sought. With the radio phonograph set up, the next problem was records. A rule was made that every man who went into town had to buy at least one. This was fairly costly contribution, as records cost about $1.50 each. But the officers came through nobly, and they now have a collection of 30 records, mostly of American swing bands and American girl singers. Each man who goes to town now has to bring back some sort of treat. This usually means peanuts or candy. They disappear in short order, but they relieve the monotony. The officers got 2 50-gallon gasoline drums and mounted them on scaffolding 8 feet high. Beneath the bung taps, they hung perforated beer cans. Underneath, they dug a ditch, which they covered with planks. And there was a shower bath in the desert. Now friends from other outfits don't drop in for lunch. They come for a shower. With similar contrivances, privates and NCOs have done almost as well for themselves. Still, there are some things the boys could use. So here are a few to remember if you have friends or relatives in the Middle East forces. American cigarettes, American magazines, phonograph records with recent hip tunes. I now return you to New York.
This has been the News of the World, reported by NBC correspondents at home and abroad. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.